Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. Holiday gift giving is always stressful, but maybe even more so this year. One way to control the frenzy and the cost is to make the gifts yourself. If you're not good at crafts, how about cooking? We have a few ideas. We also have some tips on last-minute cooking for the holidays. So let's dig in. Nicole Spiridakis writes from San Francisco about food and travel on her blog, Cucina Nicolina. She has written a piece for Kitchen Window Online about holiday gifts from the kitchen. She joins me today. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Bonnie.
You are recommending that everyone make their holiday gifts in the kitchen this year.
Yes, I recommend that everyone make their gifts. To be realistic, you know, we're probably going to pick up a few things here and there, but I have decided this year that I'm going to try to do a lot from scratch as a little bit of a money saver, but also because it's fun and I like doing the kind of personal gifting.
Have you done this in years when the economy was good, too?
I have. That's probably because I'm a little crazy and I like to do projects, but it's very satisfying to make something for someone else, and to be honest, I'm sadly unable to knit or sew, so this is kind of my only crafty thing that I can do.
And you talk about both sweet and savory things. You have poppy seed bread, caramels and truffles, flavored sea salt, preserved lemons. It's how do you choose who to give what to?
I think it's pretty easy. I think, for example, if you're going to give somebody, the sea salt, that would be someone who probably cooks often, who enjoys cooking. And I think I personally really like the salt because it just adds a little bit extra to lots of different dishes. You can use it on fish. You could use it on a roast or even vegetables in the oven. And then, of course, if you have a friend who is a big sweet tooth, the truffles are great. And if she doesn't cook very much, then she can just enjoy them as they are.
Tell me about the flavored sea salt. The recipe that you give in the piece you did for Kitchen Window Online was herbs and lemon zest?
Yes.
Dried and added to the salt. What would you use that to season?
Well, I have used it on, for example, roasted vegetables. In the spring, it's great to do just some roasted asparagus in the oven with a little olive oil. And then if you sprinkle the lemon sea salt over it, it gives it a nice little depth of flavor without being overpowering. For meat dishes, you could use it on a roast chicken or some fish roasted in the oven. It gives a nice flavor.
So anytime something savory calls for salt, you could...
It's pretty much, yes, you could use it in place for, also if a recipe calls for sea salt, a savory dish that calls for sea salt, you could substitute your flavored sea salt.
Speaking of lemons, you give a recipe for preserved lemons, which is a wonderful thing to cook with, and it's often used in North African cooking and Moroccan cooking. Where else can you use preserved lemons?
I'm a vegetarian, so I mostly use it when I do sautéed spinach, and I will add some preserved lemons at the end. And I don't know if that's a traditional dish, but it just tastes really good. And I also can add it to a couscous dish or a vegetable tagine dish, but I think traditionally you can add it to meat dishes.
You give two recipes for candy. Caramels and truffles. Do you make other kinds of candy? There's a lot of pretty easy candy to make.
There are. I chose these two just because I love truffles, and I think everyone loves to receive a box of truffles, and they're fairly easy to make. And then the recipe I use, you can also add, nuts or different kinds of chocolate or even dried fruit. But another great candy recipe is, peanut brittle or nut brittle, I guess you could say.
Right.
So, and that keeps really well. I was getting a little overzealous with the recipe, so I had to cut it off. But that's something I would definitely include, in some of my gift boxes this year that I'm going to make.
Do you ever make fruitcake?
I don't.
Are you anti-fruitcake? I know there are two schools.
No, it's funny. I just had a conversation with my coworker the other day about fruitcake, and we were both kind of like, fruitcake, huh, maybe we'll skip it this year. But I love chocolate, so I think that most of the gifts that I will be giving will include some sort of chocolate.
Do the gifts that you give include a recipe?
You know, they don't actually, but that's a great idea. Although I did do, which I mentioned in the article, I did do a bean soup once, kind of a dried bean soup, and I did put a recipe on that. But I figure that a lot of the people that I give my gifts to, for example, my grandma, she doesn't do a lot of baking, so she doesn't really need the recipe. But I think that's a great idea. And I think if you're sending gifts to people or giving them, it would be nice to include a recipe.
Nicole, thank you so much, and I wish you a happy holiday.
Thank you, too.
That was food writer Nicole Spiridakis. Sometimes you don't have enough notice to cook in advance. Alton Brown, host of the Food Network's show Good Eats and author of several food books, joined NPR's Jennifer Ludden in 2004 to offer some advice on last-minute desserts.
So let's turn to cakes now. Another one of those mysteries. How can it go into the oven so well and then come out with this big sinkhole in the middle? Is there any way to avoid
that? Well, you know, a lot of things happen in an oven. And, you know, and it's funny because cakes are one of those things that when you talk to professional bakers and people that write recipes for cakes, they talk about, you hear the words formula and you hear words like balanced. And talk about a balanced formula. Everything in a cake, every single ingredient interrelates with another ingredient. It's like an engine. And one little thing gets adjusted in the engine, it can throw off the entire system, you know, which is why we have mechanics and why mechanics frustrate us because they say, well, you know, it could be this or it could be that. And it's exactly the same thing with a cake. When a cake goes into an oven, you know, so promising, there's that liquidous batter. A lot of things start happening. The bubbles that you may have worked into that that cake when you creamed it. You know, it's funny. Most people think that the bubbles that make a cake rise in the oven are actually formed by the leavening that we add, things like baking powder, baking soda, but they're really not. The bubbles that get blown into most cakes happen during that mysterious creaming method. And if you've made a cake from a recipe, you've probably seen that word, cream the butter and the sugar together. Have you indeed seen this in a recipe? Well, what's really happening there is that the sugar is being used as an abrasive to kind of bust into the butter and form a little micro bubble. Those bubbles, that's all the bubble that is going to be in that cake. What then happens is that when you build the rest of the batter, the chemical leavening that we typically see in cakes, things like the baking powder, just blow up those bubbles. It doesn't make them. It blows them up. So one of the first things that can kind of go haywire is that you didn't cream the batter correctly. So it looks like you've got a good cake batter, but in essence, it's already kind of flawed. It's already chinked at a molecular or cellular level.
Well, moving from science to urban legend, what if children run through the kitchen? Does that make a cake fall?
No. Even I've
can't
never
we tell
seen
ourselves
that happen.
That's, you know, why
I
fell.
You could tell yourself, you know, if you really need an excuse, odds are that it was operator error and not the kid. You know, that's an urban legend, culinary legend that you hear a lot with souffles as well. Now, I'm not going to tell you that, you know, if you live by the San Andreas Fault and it's quake day, that, you know, an 8.4 isn't going to have an effect on the batter. But I have, you know, in the modern American home, unless your child is the size of a draft horse, that's just not going to happen.
Okay,
it's just not an effect. What is an effect is opening that oven door, messing around, looking in there, deciding to spin it, not allowing the oven to preheat properly. Heat is usually, or management of heat is usually, you know, the oven based culprit. You know, once a cake goes into the oven, it really needs to be left alone for heat to do its job. If you open that door even a little bit, you're letting out a huge amount of heat, and that changes everything.
All right. Well, I can't let you go without asking this. About this fun fact. You've said it's documented that a lot of architecture students end up becoming bakers.
Pastry chefs specifically, but yeah, bakers. Huh. You see a lot of that because it's all about structure. You know, there is a lot in architecture and in building that is also in pastries and cakes. I mean, when you think about it, if you've got something like a cream puff and you open up a cream puff and you see a giant space on the inside, that's like an atrium in a hotel. And the structures that hold the walls up in a hotel are the same kind of things that you have to take into consideration with that cream puff. So, you know, starch is concrete, steel is protein. It makes sense.
Okay, we'll believe you. Alton Brown of the Food Network show Good Eats, thank you.
Hey, thanks for having me. See you again.
Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and lots of recipes for the holidays and any time of year. Join us next time. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.